looking at Matthew 24, verses 3 to 35. And in verse 3, the disciples ask Jesus two questions. Question number one, when will these things be? What things? Well, the things that Jesus has just mentioned to them in the previous verse, talking about the temple. Truly, I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. The temple, he's saying there, is going to be completely destroyed. And the disciples' first question then relates to that. When is that going to happen? They're asking. And then question number two, what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age? Now, that is one question. They know that Jesus' coming will be decisive. History won't rumble on for another 1,000 years after Jesus' coming, as some Christians have thought. No, Jesus' coming and the close of the age are one and the same thing. And the disciples are asking them, how will we know when that is imminent? How will we know when that is about to happen? So those are their two questions. When will the destruction of the temple take place, and what will be the sign that precedes the second coming? And Jesus answers their two questions. He answers the question about the destruction of the temple in verses 4 to 35. And he answers the question about the second coming from verse 36 onwards, including indeed the next chapter. Now, we couldn't possibly look at all of that this morning, and so we're confining ourselves to Jesus' answer to question one, verses 4 to 35. These verses are all about the destruction of the Jerusalem temple, and at least two main emphases then relating to that event come across here. So first of all, the event's schedule. The event's schedule. Not schedule, we're not Americans. The event's schedule. Now, in answer to his disciples' when question, Jesus doesn't talk in terms of dates. The first century Jews weren't as into dates as we are. But that's not to say that Jesus is vague and nebulous here. He doesn't provide a date for the destruction of the temple, but he does provide a detailed three-part schedule nonetheless. Let's follow it through. So first of all, he talks about an initial period during which the event is still some time off. An initial period during which the event is still some time off. And this is verses 4 to 14. And this then will be a difficult period, both inside and outside the Christian church. Outside the church, there will be confusion, verse 5. Jews who hadn't recognized Jesus as the Christ being fooled by various revolutionary figures making messianic claims. And there will also be calamity, verses 6 and 7, wars, famines, and earthquakes. Inside the church, meanwhile, there will be the problem of affliction, verse 9, believers being persecuted, martyred, and widely hated, and also the problem of apostasy, verses 10 to 12, professing Christians, embracing false teaching, rejecting godly living, and turning against those they had previously deemed brothers and sisters in Christ. Having said all that, this period won't be without its encouragements as well. Alongside the defectors, there will be those who keep the faith, who endure to the end and are saved, verse 30. And for all the affliction and apostasy, another A word will also come through, advance, verse 14. The proclamation of the gospel will find its way right across the known world of that time. So what is this period then? This difficult period, when the destruction of the temple is still some time off. And that, by the way, is what the end means in verse 6 and verse 14. The end there doesn't mean the end of the age, like in verse 3. It's a different Greek word, actually. It means the end of the temple, because it's the question about the temple that Jesus is answering at this point in the passage. So what is this difficult period when the end of the temple is still some time off? Well, it's the next few decades after Jesus has gone back into heaven, what we know as the New Testament period, essentially. That's what verses 4 to 14 are about. And indeed, the New Testament documents all of these phenomena that Jesus foretells here. Confusion caused by false messiahs. Remember, there's that passing reference in Acts 21, verse 38, to one revolutionary figure who gathered a following of 4,000 men in the wilderness about the same time that Paul was going around ministering. Well, that's the kind of thing that Jesus is talking about here. Calamity. You remember in Acts 11, verse 28, a famine is mentioned that badly affected that first century world. Christians being afflicted. Well, turn anywhere in the book of Acts or indeed to any New Testament epistle and you'll find evidence of that. Christians apostatizing. Think of that church in Ephesus. And in Acts, things are so encouraging there. But later on, Timothy is based in Ephesus, and Paul writes those two letters to his poor, beleaguered young friend, and it's clear that things are now very amiss, with folk right, left, and centre swerving from the truth and shipwrecking their faith, to borrow just a couple of Paul's depressing phrases. But then, of course, believers enduring to the end and being saved. There are those as well in that New Testament period. Stephens, who died triumphantly. Older men and women, even in that Ephesian church, whom Timothy is to treat as his own fathers and mothers, 1 Timothy 5, 1 and 2. And advance of the gospel, well, the New Testament is full of that. Paul can say in Colossians 1, 23, that it has been proclaimed in all creation now, all creation under heaven, he said. So the New Testament period is what is in view in verses 4 to 14. And by the way, these verses should keep us from romanticizing those decades as though they were some kind of golden age. In reality, they were a mixed bag of discouragements and encouragements. And if we shouldn't romanticize that period, then by extension, we probably shouldn't romanticize any other period of church history either. And say, rather self-pityingly, oh, if only we had lived then in the good old days. Rather than now. In reality, for the Church of Jesus Christ, every period is a mixed bag of discouragements and encouragements. That was true of the decades following Jesus' ascension. It's true of our own time. And it has been true of every period in between. So that's the first part then of this schedule, verses 4 to 14. But then secondly, Jesus talks about a period immediately preceding the event. A period immediately preceding the event. And this is verses 15 to 22. And the difficulties of those previous few decades that we've just talked about now suddenly pale into insignificance. As the destruction of the temple becomes imminent, things really start to get nasty. In particular, this period is characterized by three traumas. Trauma number one, desecration. Desecration before the temple is destroyed, it's going to be desecrated, verse 15. Now, the details of this aren't spelt out. There's just that reference to Daniel's prophecy. Daniel prophesied about an abomination that would be introduced within the very temple of God. When I preached on Daniel a little while ago, I interpreted that, along with quite a few other things Daniel foretells, in terms of the Greek king Antiochus Epiphanes and the horrors that he would inflict on Jerusalem in the second century BC. And I don't think Jesus' words here cast doubt on that interpretation. Daniel's prophecy was fulfilled when Antiochus erected a pagan idol in Yahweh's holy sanctuary. Jesus is merely saying that it's going to have a further additional fulfillment when the temple, during this period that he's talking about, undergoes a similar desecration all over again. So that's one trauma that will occur in the period immediately preceding the temple's destruction, desecration. Trauma number two, flight. Flight. The people of Jerusalem and the surrounding area desperately fleeing their home. such flight, of course, is a major phenomenon in our own day, isn't it? Thousands and thousands of people coming into Europe from parts of Asia and North Africa, fleeing war and poverty and religious persecution. And we've seen those poor people on our TV screens and should be under no illusions, therefore, regarding the hardships and indignities involved in fleeing like that. But Jesus details some of those hardships and indignities anyway. The problem of lacking essential provisions as you flee. Because apart from anything else, the flight was so urgent that you didn't have time to gather such provisions from your house and bring them, verses 17 and 18. The problem of women being pregnant and thus somewhat immobile, or being at the breastfeeding stage and thus having to stop frequently, verse 19. The problem of winter conditions making travel difficult and heightening the need for warmth and shelter, verse 20. For those reasons and many others, of course, fleeing your home is not an exciting adventure. It's a dangerous and heartbreaking business. And that's the second trauma there that will occur in this period immediately preceding the temple's destruction, flight. And then trauma number three, tribulation. Tribulation. What does Jesus mean when he uses that word in verse 21? Well, he's probably referring to siege. In our modern world, as I said just now, we can relate to flight. We can relate to people having to flee from their homes, but we can't really relate to siege, can we? Modern warfare doesn't involve siege. But in the ancient world, few situations were more horrific than that of a city under siege, having the life, as it were, slowly strangled out of it. There's a clue that siege is in Jesus' mind in the mention in verse 22 of those days being cut short. The Roman siege that preceded the destruction of the temple was indeed cut short. Because after 5 months, and ancient sieges could last an awful lot longer than 5 months, after 5 months, it ended due to the Romans successfully capturing the city. It's interesting, by the way, that Jesus says there in verse 22 that it will be for the sake of the elect that those days will be cut short. It reminds me of that moment when Paul is on that storm-tossed Mediterranean voyage. And he's told by an angel, God has granted you all those who sail with you, Acts 27, 24. Which is either a very, very random comment on the part of the angel, or Paul has been praying to God for all his fellow travelers, that they would survive the storm. And the angel is saying then, Paul, God has given you this thing that you have been praying for. In other words, that pagan, godless ship's company was spared a worse outcome in that storm. They all got safely onto shore, Malta, because a believer was among them and he was praying. And perhaps here too then, this wicked, rebellious city, Jerusalem, will be spared a worse outcome in this siege. It will only last 5 months, relatively short, because there will be believers among the city's inhabitants, elect men and women, and they will pray. Who knows if God has perhaps spared our society from more terrorist attacks over the years, and from worse governments over the years, and from more coronavirus deaths over recent months, because many people in Great Britain are believers, and those believers hold prayer meetings in their churches and intercede before God regarding those matters. And God hears, and for the sake of the elect, is merciful towards this land. Anyway, that's the period then, immediately preceding the destruction of the temple, a period marked by desecration, blight, and tribulation. But then the third part of the schedule, thirdly, Jesus talks about the event itself. And that's verse 29. It says, immediately after the tribulation of those days. Remember, we just said the tribulation is the siege of Jerusalem. Immediately after the siege of Jerusalem, that's when the event itself finally occurs and the temple is smashed to smithereens. Now, don't be thrown by the rather epic cosmic language that verse 29 uses. That language is drawn from a couple of texts in Isaiah. So Isaiah chapter 13 and verse 10 says, the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. What's Isaiah talking about there? Well, that whole passage begins in verse 1 of Isaiah 13, the oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw. So it's all about Babylon, Isaiah 13 is. What about Babylon? Well, look at verses 17 to 19 of Isaiah 13. Yahweh says, behold, I am stirring up the Medes against them. And so he goes on, then verse 19, Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the splendor and pomp of the Chaldeans will be like Sodom and Gomorrah when God overthrew them. So Babylon is going to be overthrown by the Medes. That's what Isaiah 13 is all about. And that then is what's being described when Isaiah makes that foray into cosmic language about the stars and the sun and the moon being darkened. He's describing the overthrow of Babylon by the Medes. The other text is Isaiah 34, verse 4, where similar language, all the host of heaven shall rot away and the skies roll up like a scroll. All their hosts, that's the stars, shall fall as leaves fall from the vine, like leaves falling from the fig tree. What's Isaiah talking about there? Well, the very next verse tells us. He continues, for my sword has drunk its fill in the heavens. Behold, it descends for judgment upon Edom, upon the people I have devoted to destruction. The kingdom of Edom is going to be overthrown. And again, that too causes Isaiah to reach then for this very grand cosmic language. And here in Matthew 24, verse 29, then Jesus is taking his cue from Isaiah. The center point of Israel is Jerusalem, and the center point of Jerusalem is the temple. And when the temple is demolished, then stone by stone, Israel will have well and truly bitten the dust. She will have come crashing down just as emphatically as Babylon and Edom several centuries earlier. And so it's perfectly appropriate for Jesus to foretell Israel's overthrow in just the same way Isaiah had foretold Babylon's and Edom's, employing the same epic cosmic language. So that's the three-part schedule then for the destruction of the temple. There's going to be, first of all, an initial period during which the event is still some time off. There's going to be, secondly, a period immediately preceding the event. And then thirdly, there's going to be the event itself. And while we said Jesus doesn't provide any date, don't miss that crucial detail in verse 34. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. In other words, the whole three-part process is going to unfold within the lifetimes of those Jesus is addressing. He says in verses 32 and 33 that they'll be able to watch stage one giving way to stage two and know then that stage three is just around the corner. By the way, we should read verse 33 as it is near. You know, when you see all these things, you know it is near, not he is near. It's equally valid in terms of the Greek, and it makes far more sense because Jesus is talking about the destruction of the temple. But I'm saying then, these disciples will be able to watch the whole thing unfolding. Of course, in the light of verse 9, men, they may have been martyred by the time that the event occurred. But theoretically, at least, They'll be able to watch the entire three-part process unfolding because it will all happen, Jesus says, within a single generation. And it did. Jesus was right about this schedule. He was right about its three stages, and he was right about the single generation thing. The next 40 years followed exactly the course that Jesus sets out here, and in 70 AD, the temple did indeed come crashing down. Jesus says in the last verse of our passage, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." And sure enough, the words of this prophecy did not pass away. They weren't superseded by an actual course of events that diverged significantly. They weren't left looking silly and laughable like all those predictions of a millennium bug that people were making in the late 1990s. No, the words of this prophecy proved solid and reliable. And that should give us something to think about this morning. You may not care very much about what happened to Jerusalem and its temple almost 2,000 years ago. But if what happened to Jerusalem and its temple 2,000 years ago confirmed that Jesus' words do not pass away, that Jesus in a unique and remarkable way speaks the truth, then that's relevant to you. That's relevant. It's relevant to you because Jesus is going to go on to say from verse 36 onwards that he's coming back one day. He's coming back to this earth. He's coming back to end history and judge the lives of all human beings. Now, if his words don't pass away, if his words are reliable and solid, if he speaks the truth, then you'd better be ready. You'd better be ready for that coming back of Jesus at the very end of history. Well, then again, it's relevant to you, because back in chapter 11, verse 28, Jesus said, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." And you want rest. I know you do. You want that contentment and satisfaction that's deep-seated, that's in the soul. And you know that you haven't attained it through career or possessions or family or sex or anything else. You know that it eludes you still this morning. Well, you should go to Jesus without delay, because if his words don't pass away, if he speaks the truth, then that applies too to that great invitation he made. Come to me. I will give you rest. I mean, it seems crazy on the face of things. How could one Palestinian man stand up and say, the whole world can come to me and I will give their souls rest? What a claim. But the fall of the Jerusalem temple in AD 70 shows that we should take Jesus' claims seriously. And we should take that one seriously. This morning, in your deep-seated dissatisfaction, your endless quest for fulfillment that keeps sending you down this avenue and that avenue, and you hit another brick wall and another brick wall, take Jesus' invitation seriously. His words don't pass away. Go to him. Say, Lord Jesus, please give me that rest that you promised all those years ago. So we've considered then the event schedule. But secondly, and much more briefly, let's consider the event's significance. The event's significance. The disciples' questions there in verse 3 are interesting, aren't they? I mean, the first question is completely understandable. Jesus has just brought up the subject of the destruction of the temple, so it's natural that they should then ask him, when will these things be? But why do they attach that second question about the second coming? It seems a bit random. What's the second coming got to do with it? Well, I think this is the bit. The disciples simply assume that an event as momentous as the destruction of the temple must bring with it the end of the age. The temple was such a fixture. It was so much part of the fabric of reality for first century Jews. They could not contemplate the world just carrying on without it. The destruction of the temple was too seismic an occurrence to be contained within history. It must surely terminate history. That seems to be the reason for the disciples adding that second question. And apparently the disciples wouldn't be alone in thinking like that. Jesus indicates in verses 23 to 26 that on the brink of the event, with Jerusalem under siege and the fall of the city becoming inevitable, there would be rumors flying around about the arrival of Messiah. Some saying he has been seen in the wilderness, others saying he has been seen in the inner rooms of the temple. So I'm saying that this, for many, was the obvious significance of the destruction of the temple. It marked the coming of the Messiah. For unbelieving Jews, the first and only coming of the Messiah. For believers like these disciples, the second coming of Jesus, the Messiah. But notice Jesus will have none of it. When these rumors circulates, he says in verse 23 and again in verse 26, do not believe it. Do not believe it. He goes on to say in verse 27 that when the second coming does transpire, it won't be the stuff of rumors. It will be as unambiguous and unmistakable, he says, as a flash of lightning. By the way, it is perhaps just worth mentioning here that Christians whose theology and whose theology of the end of the world is normally very clear and robust can suddenly be thrown by events happening in the world that are unusual, abnormal, once in a generation events, whether it's the dropping of a nuclear bomb or whether it's the outbreak of a global pandemic, whatever it might be. Christians can suddenly become susceptible to the kind of sensationalist rumors that Jesus mentions there in verse 26. And we must be clear there. We must be clear. In a world where there will be, from time to time, very abnormal, very weird, very strange occurrences, we must be clear that the Son of Man coming is in a different category altogether. It will be unmistakable and it will be unambiguous. We need to be clear on that and not thrown there in the way that there was the danger these disciples would be thrown when unimaginable things happen within history. So the significance of the destruction of the temple is not that it marks the end of the world. Does it have any significance then? Well, yes, it does. And we're just going to close this morning then looking at verses 30 and 31. And it's important to examine carefully what those verses are saying. They begin, verse 30, then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. I think it's better, however, to rearrange that clause so that it reads like this. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. In other words, it's not the sign that's in heaven, as the ESV makes it sound. It's the Son of Man who is in heaven. A sign that's in heaven would actually be pretty useless and self-defeating. I mean, what's the purpose of a sign? The whole purpose of a sign is to show something. But if a sign is in heaven, then by definition, it's invisible to the inhabitants of earth here. And so it's not showing us anything. So as I say, it's the Son of Man that is in heaven. And that's what the last part of verse 30 is about as well. That's another allusion there. Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. That's another allusion to Daniel, this time Daniel chapter 7. And where in Daniel chapter 7 does the Son of Man go on the clouds? Well, listen. Daniel 7, verse 13. I saw in the night visions, Daniel says. And behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days, and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. So where does the Son of Man go? Traveling on the clouds, he goes into the presence of the Ancient of Days. That is, he goes into heaven, where he is given a kingdom. In other words, Daniel 7 and this verse here that we're looking at, Matthew 24, verse 30, they are talking about Jesus' enthronement, his ascension into heaven following the completion of his mission here on earth, his coronation, his crowning, his being seated on the throne and given a kingdom there in heaven. So, verse 30 is saying then that the Son of Man is now in heaven, reigning. But that, of course, is invisible, as we just said a minute ago. Things that are happening in heaven are invisible to us here on earth. So the Son of Man reigning in heaven, seated on his heavenly throne with all authority in heaven and on earth, that is invisible to us. However, that's why it's accompanied by a sign that manifests on earth this reality that Jesus is now reigning in heaven. What's the sign? Well, it's the destruction of the temple, of course. Look at the logical sequence here. Verse 29, we said, describes, using Old Testament cosmic language, the destruction of the temple. Verse 30 begins by saying that that destruction of the temple is a sign. And that sign means, the verse continues, that the tribes, and it shouldn't read here, I think, the tribes of the earth. Some of you will know the Greek word for earth is the same as the Greek word for land. The tribes of the land, that is the land of Israel, the tribes of Israel is talking about here. The tribes of Israel, the Jews, mourning over the destruction of their temple, have at the same time the opportunity to see via the sign that is the destruction of the temple, the reality that Jesus is now reigning in heaven. Many of them, of course, will refuse to see that. But for those who have eyes to see the sign, their mourning will turn to joy. Who cares that the temple is gone? They will cry. Jesus is now reigning. For those with eyes to see, the destruction of the temple is the sign that Jesus has taken his throne in heaven and is reigning with all authority given to him. But notice too that the destruction of the temple is only part of the sign that Jesus is now reigning. Verse 31 continues, and he, that is the Son of Man, will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. What's that talking about? Well, it's talking about the gathering of the elect from all over the world that's happening now, in this age, through the preaching of the gospel. The angels mentioned there may just mean human messengers. The word angel is really just a messenger. And so it may mean human messengers going out preaching the gospel, or it may be that Jesus is referring here literally to supernatural angels. Alan reminded us the other Wednesday night of how involved angels are in the life of the church now, and angels are presumably involved then in the proclamation of the gospel in all kinds of ways. And so that may be the reference here. But the proclamation of the gospel across the world and the ingathering of the elect through the proclamation of that gospel, that too, Jesus is saying, is part of the sign, the earthly sign of this heavenly reality that Jesus is reigning. As the elect are gathered in, that is manifesting that Jesus is on the throne. I wonder whether you sometimes wonder to yourself, is Jesus really reigning? Jesus really on the throne in such a messed up world? In a world where pandemics do rage and where people get randomly stabbed in a park on Saturday? A world of such difficulty, crisis and calamity? Is Jesus really reigning? You may remember vaguely that in the second half of last year, on a Sunday evening, we had that series, Cosmic War. And I talked there about Jesus' enthronement, his ascension. And I took you to those passages that portray it as such a grand event. Ephesians chapter 4, Jesus leading captives in his wake as he ascends up on high. 1 Peter 3, Jesus proclaiming his victory to the evil spirits who have now been made his captives. Colossians chapter 2 there, verse 15, I think it is. Jesus, again, stripping evil powers, humiliating them, like the prisoners at the end of a Roman victory parade as they came back from war. And it all sounds so grand, doesn't it, when you read those New Testament texts, but we can't see any of that. We can't see the elect angels celebrating with great fanfare, Jesus taking his throne, and all the wicked angels, the wicked spirits being mocked and humiliated as their defeat is thus confirmed. It's all in a realm that we can't access. And you sometimes perhaps think, well, is this really the case? Or is it just make-believe? Well, Jesus is encouraging us here to look at the last 2,000 years of history and the way in which the Church of Christ has grown from these feeble men sitting at Jesus' feet on the Mount of Olives on this day, grown from that to what it is today, this huge phenomenon, encompassing so many nations, so many nationalities. And historians and sociologists will scratch their heads and try to come up with explanations of how this one religion has managed to be so phenomenally successful. But Jesus is saying, look, it's actually the earthly sign of a heavenly reality that I'm on the throne. That's the explanation. That's how the Church has grown from what it was on the Mount of Olives this day to what it is on the 21st of June 2020. It's because I'm reigning. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. And I'm saying that revel in the sheer growth and size of the Christian Church this morning. When you're doubting whether Jesus is on the throne, just look. Might not be wonderful evidence of it in your street, in your community, in your city. But look at the world. Look at what's happening. Look at how big the Church is. And say to yourself, that's the sign. That's the earthly sign of this heavenly reality. Jesus reigns. May all of us in a messed up world be encouraged by that. Amen.